You're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 14, On the Eve. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. The last few episodes have witnessed the shifts happening across Russian society as the bourgeois order of the provisional government has broken down in both the cities and the villages in the fall of 1917. In this episode, we are going to turn our attention back to the capital Petrograd and discuss the final shuffling within the government, the Soviets, and the Bolshevik Party in the lead-up to the Bolshevik-controlled Soviets taking power. We will start with Lenin finally making it back to Petrograd, since his presence will influence everything else that happens in a profound way. Next, we will go through the Bolsheviks exiting the pre-parliament, something I mentioned briefly in the last episode and promised to explain in more detail. After that, we will talk about the struggle for the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets. From there, we will go through the fateful meeting of the Bolshevik Central Committee on the 10th of October, why this meeting was important, and what the aftermath was. We will close out by talking about the formation of the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet, the committee that was fated to be the launching pad of the Great October Revolution. Frankly, that is a ton to get through, so let's just dive in, shall we? Lenin re-entered Petrograd proper on the 29th of September. Since July, he had been outside the capital, first in Finland, and then, after the Kornilov coup had been thwarted by the masses, he had started approaching closer and closer to the capital, spending most of September in the northwest suburbs of Petrograd. This whole time, and even after returning to Petrograd, he had had to stay as incognito as possible, as there was technically still a warrant for his arrest. He famously shaved his beard and donned a wig as a disguise. If you've ever seen that photo of Lenin clean-shaven, and if you've seen it, you know the one. It was taken during this period. The thing that impelled him to return was, as I mentioned in episode 12, the fact that no matter what he wrote or where he published, the leadership of the Bolshevik Party could not be persuaded to make a move on the provisional government. For reasons we will explore, this became simply intolerable for Lenin. He knew he had to be present to convince his comrades to do what he now believed must be done, overthrow the provisional government, and to do this as quickly as possible. In April, he had returned to Petrograd to cheers from workers, had been greeted by his comrades, and began immediately making public speeches. In October, he snuck back into the city quietly, hoping nobody recognized him or turned him in, calling secret meetings and attending public meetings incognito. Although on the surface the two events were as different as can be, there was one commonality. In both the spring and the fall, Lenin took a calculated risk he believed was worth it in order to further the cause of the proletarian revolution. As it turned out, Lenin's return came not a minute too soon. Recall that the Provisional Council of the Russian Republic, known better as the pre-parliament, was formed out of the Democratic Conference in September as an advisory body for Kerensky and his government. At that time, there was a debate in the Bolshevik Party about whether to even participate. Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, and others wanted to boycott the whole thing, saying it was a distraction from the work of organizing and preparing the proletariat and the masses of Russia for a revolution. But Kamenev, Zinoviev, and their supporters believed it was very important to participate in an effort to maintain formal connection with the government and try to use legal means to achieve the party's goals. When we last left the matter, the Kamenev-Zinoviev wing had emerged triumphant toward the end of September, and the Bolshevik Party appointed a delegation to the pre-parliament. The pre-parliament was then set to meet on the 6th of October, although I've also seen the 7th given as the date. And of course, absolutely no funny business occurred between the end of the Democratic Conference and the start of the pre-parliament. Right? Huh. Right. During this intermission between the Democratic Conference and the pre-parliament, Kerensky was able to hobble together a third and final coalition government. The details of this process are not terribly interesting or important, since this coalition will be around for less than a month. But one of the first official acts of this new government was to unilaterally change the composition of the pre-parliament, and in a way that seemed precisely calculated to provoke a severe backlash from the masses. Remember from episode 12 how we saw that the cadets were hated at this point, tainted as they were by their support for Kornilov? How the one thing the other left and center-left groups could agree on at the Democratic Conference was that the cadets should not be allowed in the government anymore in any capacity? Well, guess who just got assigned a delegation by Kerensky in the pre-parliament without any discussion with the Soviets or the other political parties? I'll give you a hint. It wasn't the coal miners' union. Trotsky gives the following figures for the composition of the pre-parliament after Kerensky shoved the cadets back into everyone's faces. Quote, "The so-called democratic majority of the pre-parliament consisted of 308 individuals, 108 SRs, including about 20 leftists, 60 Mensheviks of various shades, 66 Bolsheviks. Next came the cooperatives, delegates, and the peasant executive committee," note, "of the all-Russian peasant Soviet," quote, etc. 156 seats were presented to the owning classes, nearly half of which the cadets occupied. Along with the cooperatives, the Cossack delegates, and the fairly conservative members of the Peasant Executive Committee, the right wing was close to a majority on an entire series of questions. In this manner, the distribution of seats found itself in flagrant contradiction with all decisively expressed wishes of the city and the village. End quote. Why did Kerensky do this? I think there are two reasons. One, Kerensky simply could not conceive of a government without heavy representation of the bourgeoisie. In fact, many of the ministerial positions in this final coalition were held by the Cadet Party, with only a few held by the Mensheviks and SRs. We will talk more about this in a retrospective episode of the Russian Revolution that's coming up, but the Socialist Revolutionaries and the Mensheviks were very dogmatic and orthodox in their Marxism. They believed that, since Marx had theorized that after the rule of monarchs under feudalism must come the rule of the bourgeoisie and capitalism, and since Russia had only earlier that year shaken off the chains of its monarch, it followed necessarily that the Russian bourgeoisie must have their turn to run things. Now, whether that was really Marx's position, and whether the SRs and Mensheviks were correct in their dogmatic adherence to such a rigid interpretation of Marx, will be discussed in that retrospective episode. But for now, this dogmatic adherence meant that Kerensky believed the cadets, as the single biggest party of the bourgeoisie in Russia, simply had to be involved in the governance of Russia in some fashion. It is therefore unsurprising that the cadets were able to keep forcing themselves onto the Russian people. The socialist in name, petty bourgeois indeed, Menshevik and SR parties simply did not believe they had the historic right to stand up to them. Of course, it must also be kept in mind that the Prime Minister himself, despite nominally being a member of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, was really a petty bourgeois liberal intellectual. This should be rather obvious by now. Prior to the revolution, Kerensky was an attorney, and yes, while he mostly defended peasants and workers from landlords and bosses, he also owned a few businesses in his time, and, well, literally every action he has taken since becoming prime minister has been in favor of the owning class and against the interests of the peasants and workers. This fact of his background and placement in the class divide of Russian society, in and of itself, predisposed him to collaborating with the bourgeoisie. But the second reason Kerensky forced this change in the pre-parliament was because, frankly, he was arrogant enough to think he could do it and get away with it. And in a sense, he did. We are about to see the Bolsheviks walk out of the pre-parliament, but they will not be joined by anyone else. For all their talk of disgust at the cadets and never-again-ism about a possible second coup attempted by the cadets or the military, The SRs and Mensheviks, after a lot of grumbling, more or less just accepted that this was how it was going to be. Again, these parties may have called themselves socialists, but if it walks like a petty bourgeois ideologue, and talks like a petty bourgeois ideologue, and prostrates itself in front of the bourgeoisie like a petty bourgeois ideologue, chances are, it's a duck. But here's the thing. However arrogant Kerensky was, he was twice as delusional. He simply had no grasp on how out of favor he, his government, and the parties that supported him were among the workers of Petrograd, the soldiers of the capital and the front, and the people in the cities and villages across the country. But boy howdy, is he about to find out. Anyway, to get back to it, Kerensky and his new government's little maneuver came as, if not a shock to the Bolsheviks, then at least a jolt. I doubt anyone in the party could have been genuinely surprised that Kerensky did what he did, but this blatant disregard for the expressed will of the Soviets reinvigorated Lenin and his allies in the party. They had never really stopped trying to drum up support for the position of boycotting the pre-parliament. Faced with this sudden bait and switch from the government and the renewed calls for a boycott, the Central Committee decided to reassess its decision to participate in the pre-parliament. This time, the vote in the Central Committee was nearly unanimous. Every member present, save Kamenev, voted for a walkout from the pre-parliament. As it turned out, this decision coincided with a meeting of the Executive Commission of the Petersburg Committee, which was holding its own session on this very question, and coming to the same conclusion. They did not want to take part in the pre-parliament any longer. And the Petersburg Committee was not alone in this sentiment. Along with plenty of other regional committees, a majority of the Bolsheviks had, under the constant persuasive influence of Lenin, and in light of the government's obvious attempts at stacking the deck against the popular will of the Russian people, also soured on the pre-parliament. I do want to take a beat here very quickly just to clarify the roles of all these committees, because I know this is a lot and can get confusing very easily. The Petersburg Committee was the Petrograd branch of the Bolshevik Party. Remember, this branch had formed well before the war when Petrograd was still called St. Petersburg, just as it is today. And the party did not change the name of the committee when the name of the city was changed, which I am sure they did just to keep things spicy. The Central Committee was the leadership for the entire Bolshevik Party across all of Russia, tasked with developing a political line and coordinating strategy for the party as a whole. The Executive Commission was the leadership of specifically the Petersburg Committee. Oh, but don't get this confused with the Executive Committee as the leading body of the Petrograd Soviet, because that's a completely different thing altogether. Got all that? As the Russians would say, без бутылки не разберешься. Without a bottle of booze, you'll never figure it out. Several factors were important in the relationship between the Central Committee and the Petersburg Committee. They both were meeting in Petrograd, and although the Central Committee is a party-wide organ and so had supremacy over the Petersburg Committee was by far the most important local committee in the entire party. To avoid friction and maintain camaraderie relations between the two most important committees in the party effectively sharing the same space in Petrograd, they agreed that the Central Committee would check in with the Petersburg Committee before officially handing down decisions on strategy and policy for the party, while the Petersburg Committee agreed not to do anything that would impact the entire party without the approval or sanction of the Central Committee. There is, however, one particularly juicy detail I just have to share. When Lenin was still outside of Petrograd, flooding the Central Committee with correspondences and demands that they adopt a line of preparing for armed insurrection against the government, the Central Committee had instead attempted to conceal and suppress Lenin's ideas and arguments. When the Petersburg Committee, which had always been much more militant compared to the Central Committee, found out about this, they were, not pleased. They were understandably scandalized by the Central Committee keeping Lenin's arguments from the rest of the party, and they let their feelings be known to the Central Committee. While the government forcing the cadets into the pre-parliament was very disturbing to the Central Committee, to be sure, in terms of intra-party dynamics, it was a fierce anger of the Petersburg Committee at the Central Committee, more than anything else, that prompted the Bolshevik Party leadership to reevaluate participation in the pre-parliament. A fight with the Petersburg Committee was absolutely the last thing anyone in the Central Committee wanted. Anyway, with the new decision from the Central Committee and several other important committees from across the country that the party must boycott the pre-parliament, it all came down to the opening session, which, again, took place either the 6th or the 7th of October. Kerensky kicked off that opening session with a speech that I have to imagine took the tone of a stodgy high school principal attempting to instill the values of discipline and obedience at a school assembly, speaking to all the students present, but really talking about the troublemakers. And everyone knew who the troublemakers were. He reminded everyone present that they were there for a purely advisory role and had no official authority within the government, but promised to, of course, listen to any good faith suggestions which the pre-parliament produced. After this, Trotsky was given 10 minutes to speak on behalf of the Bolshevik delegation. Taking the rostrum, he spent his time decrying the government, denouncing the undemocratic makeup of the pre-parliament and the government of cadets, and ended with, quote, "We, the Bolshevik delegation, declare, with this government of betrayal of the people, and with this council of counter-revolutionary complicity, we have no common cause. As we leave the Provisional Committee, we call to vigilance and bravery the workers, soldiers, and peasants of all of Russia. Petrograd is in danger. The revolution is in danger. The people are in danger. We address the people. All power to the Soviets," end quote. After this speech, the Bolshevik delegation, and the Bolshevik delegation alone, stood up and left the pre-parliament. Trotsky, in his History of the Russian Revolution, muses just how relieved Kerensky and the leaders of the SRs and Mensheviks must have been that this exodus was only affected by the Bolsheviks. With them gone, maybe they can actually get down to the business of doing absolutely nothing to hold the new coalition government to account. So now we know why the Bolsheviks were not part of the talks in the pre-parliament on how to continue the war I mentioned last episode. I think in hindsight, it is fair to say that this boycott was yet another example of the correctness of the Bolsheviks and Lenin's line. By not sullying themselves, by refusing to work with a government acting in such obvious bad faith in even this limited capacity, the Bolsheviks were able to maintain their good name and present themselves, and the Soviets, in which they had majorities, as a clear and absolutely distinct alternative to the provisional government. Before we move on, though, I think it's worth stopping here for a moment to clarify a point of revolutionary theory in the Marxist-Leninist tradition. The Bolsheviks' refusal to collaborate with the government through 1917 was the correct call, yes. But this is not to say that there is a universal rule that communists or revolutionaries must refuse participation in official bourgeois government always and everywhere. In fact, Marx, Engels, and Lenin wrote extensively about the need to engage with bourgeois elections and governance, under certain material conditions, that is. For example, when there is an established bourgeois government, when participation may yield some tangible benefit for the workers, and when there is no realistic opportunity of pursuing a more revolutionary politics. They were all of them crystal clear that, above all, the main strategic goal of participation in bourgeois governance was not to change the system from the inside, or to win the revolution at the ballot box. No, the main strategic goal of participation in bourgeois governance was to demonstrate to the working class just how futile an avenue bourgeois politics is for addressing their grievances, and for signaling to each other where their support in the masses lay. Whatever electoral strategy the working class may or may not pursue, it must never forget its real power. The workers are the engine of the economy, and without them, society grinds to a halt. But if Marx, Engels, and Lenin were not opposed to engaging in bourgeois electoral politics, why was it the correct strategy in 1917 Russia to boycott them? Because the material conditions indicated that it was. Let's take just the moment at hand, the exit from the pre-parliament, as an example. At this point, there is no established bourgeois Russian government fully recognized as legitimate. In fact, the institution one might consider the legitimate government of Russia has been hemorrhaging legitimacy for weeks. The tension of dual power between the government and the Soviets has been dragging on for nearly 8 months now, and in the eyes of the masses, the Soviets have morphed within that time span into a most legitimate vehicle for popular governance. A majority of workers and soldiers in Petrograd, Moscow, and elsewhere are already convinced that official electoral politics are a dead end. And more sections of the party and the masses are beginning to embrace a more revolutionary politics, especially in the wake of their impressive, energizing victory over Kornilov. Lenin and those who supported his line in the party were correct. The time had passed for engaging in bourgeois political theater. The time had come for political action. I mentioned toward the end of episode 12 that a second All-Russian Congress of Soviets was called for and ultimately scheduled for October. In order to understand, in case there is still any lingering doubt whatsoever, just how much of a hindrance the other socialist parties were to the masses' attempts at exercising their power, the struggle for this Congress is a prime example. In case anyone needs a refresher, the first Congress of Soviets was held in June and discussed in episode 8. It was a tense gathering because of the animosity between the Bolsheviks and the other socialist parties, who at the time held majorities in Soviets all across Russia. The Menshevik SR bloc of the Congress hurled the accusation that the anti-war demonstration the Bolsheviks had been planning was a sneak attack against the government, and a particularly devious one at that, the kind you announce openly to everyone days in advance in a newspaper calling for a peaceful march. No way the Mensheviks and SRs were going to be fooled by that old trick. Under pressure, the Bolsheviks backed off and canceled their coup, protest. But then, when the SR-led Congress held a pro-government, pro-war demonstration, the Bolsheviks and their constituents basically turned it into their anti-war protest, much to the chagrin of the Congress leaders. Well, it's been almost 4 months since that Congress, but so much has happened. I don't know about you, but it feels like it was 4 years ago. In September, as the Democratic Conference was coming to a close, the Petersburg Committee of the Bolsheviks put forward in the party first, which then made it to the conference via the Bolshevik delegation, a demand for a second All-Russian Congress of Soviets. This demand was prompted in large part by the fear that the government and/or army command was planning another Kornilov-like attack. Now, you might be wondering, hey, I thought the soldiers and everyone else was on the side of the Bolsheviks. What kind of attack can conservative or counter-revolutionary forces mount if they don't have anyone supporting them? And if you are wondering that, great, that is actually a very good question. The answer is, the majority of workers were mobilized behind the Bolsheviks, something like 70 to 80%, with large industrial factories being almost entirely for the Bolsheviks. However, only a critical mass of the army and peasantry were. I could not find exact figures, but something around 40 to 50% of the armed forces were either Bolsheviks or sympathetic to them. This, as it turned out, would be enough to win them the day in the end, especially as really critical sections of the armed forces, specifically the Petrograd garrison, the Baltic fleet, and many divisions deployed to the war front, were among those that supported them. But that meant there was still a large chunk of the armed forces that either the Bolsheviks could not count on, or might turn out to be hostile to them entirely. And it was basically the same story for the peasants. No hard figures, but estimates of roughly half or just under half of the peasantry across Russia are believed to have supported the Bolsheviks, which is great, but also means the rest, possibly a small majority, of the peasants are either indifferent or possibly hostile. Now, in fairness and in retrospect, there does not seem to be any direct evidence that there was another Kornilov-style coup, or any other counter-revolutionary offenses, being imminently planned. So one might say the Bolsheviks were being paranoid and lashing out. Or, if one were especially hostile to the Bolsheviks, one might accuse them of using cynical political rhetoric to play on the fears of the masses. But I would counter by reminding everyone that, at this point in history, the Bolsheviks have only the Paris Commune as the sole other example of an attempt at building a worker state. I would further remind everyone that the lesson from the Commune was, do not underestimate the lengths to which the bourgeoisie will go to destroy a workers' movement. The Paris Communards failed to grasp this lesson, and wound up slaughtered in the streets. Besides, think about everything the Bolsheviks and the workers have been through, everything we have been discussing this entire podcast series so far. With the benefit of hindsight, we know there was not an attack from the bourgeoisie government against the proletariat imminent in October 1917. But that does not mean there would not have been one at some point in the future, should the government or army decide the moment was opportune. Honestly, I don't think anyone can fault the Bolsheviks and the masses for not trusting the people who have done nothing but undermine and betray their trust for the last 8 months. The demand for a second Congress was made by the Bolsheviks at the Democratic Conference to the Central Executive Committee of the First Congress, which had been established as the Congress's acting authority after its end. I'm going to refer to the Central Executive Committee by its Russian acronym, CEK, because Central Executive Committee is a bit of a mouthful. And besides, we already have the Bolshevik Central and Petersburg Committees in the mix, and then the Executive Committee of the Petro-Soviet, so hopefully calling the Central Executive Committee the CEK helps simplify the names. The thing was, since it was formed from the First Congress of Soviets, the CEK was dominated by the Mensheviks and SRs, since they had dominated the Soviets at the time. The CEK did initially agree to call another Congress, but only after the Bolsheviks threatened to circumvent the CEK altogether and call a Congress without them. The Second Congress was initially scheduled for the 20th of October. But once the delegates of the Democratic Conference had returned home, the CEK began to backtrack. Trotsky attributes this to the desire by the CEK to focus on the Constituent Assembly, which the SR majority of the CEK saw as the organ through which they had a better chance of pursuing their own program. They wanted reconciliation with the ruling classes, and a liberal democratic republic with capitalism still as the economic base. The Constituent Assembly was especially important to the CEK now that the SRs were a minority in the Soviets across the country. They feared another Congress would both distract from the preparations for the Constituent Assembly and lead to the formation of a new CEK in which they would not be in control. And yes, you heard me. After 7 months of demands and promises and delays, the Constituent Assembly was finally back on the calendar, with elections scheduled to take place in mid-November. There will be much, much more to say about the Constituent Assembly soon enough, although if you listened to me on the deprogram, you kind of got a sneak peek already. The backtracking by the SRs and Mensheviks took the forms of calls against a second Congress appearing in their newspapers and the various local and regional committees and Soviets still under their control. However, these calls were drowned out by an upsurge of demand from workers and army committees and Soviets across Russia for the Congress. This upsurge was organized by the Bolsheviks, who had anticipated correctly that the promise to call a Congress would be rescinded as soon as the Democratic Conference ended. And so, as it turned out, they were one step ahead of the SRs and Mensheviks this time. During the campaign for a Congress, Trotsky reports this chicanery by the SRs and Mensheviks would cause some of the last remaining Soviets still under their control to abandon them, switching instead to the Bolsheviks or combined Bolshevik-left SR blocs. In the end, from Smolensk to Siberia, Kharkov to Khabarovsk, local Soviets were issuing resolutions and calls and demands for another Congress and calling it the legitimate organ of authority in Russia. In the face of this overwhelming demand from Soviets for the Tsikh to stick to its word and hold the Congress as scheduled on the 20th of October, the Tsikh blinked. The Congress would be held. However, this back and forth had taken so long that the final decision was made on the 18th of October, just days before the original start date. Because of this, the opening of the Congress had to be rescheduled from the 20th to the 25th. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is, I'm happy to say the Patreon page is fully functional now. All my current episodes have been posted there. There are different tiers with different bonuses, and we are forming a nice little community. The bad news is, you are listening to this episode late. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon first, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. Early access on Patreon starts at just $5 a month, so if you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast services you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. Now that Lenin was physically back in Petrograd, albeit trying to stay under the radar of the provisional government, he was quickly winning other Bolsheviks to his viewpoint of calling for an armed insurrection against the government. Kamenev came out as yet again one of the most conservative members of the party leadership, pleading along with his allies that such a venture was too risky. Lenin requested a meeting with the Central Committee, of which he had been a member in absentia the entire time he had been forced underground since July. The meeting took place in the apartment of the Menshevik Nikolai Nikolaevich Sukhanov, whom I do not think I've mentioned this entire series so far, but who did later on leave extensive records and memoirs of this period, which have formed the basis for a lot of the sources I have been using so far. So, a tip of the hat to him. Sukhanov, of course, was not there, but his wife, Galina Flaxerman, a Bolshevik since 1905, was happy to host the meeting, which took place on the evening of the 10th of October and lasted into the early morning of the next day. 12 committee members of a total of 21 were in attendance. They were, of course, Lenin, but also Kamenev, Zinoviev, Stalin, and Trotsky. There were other prominent Bolshevik names I'm sure some of you know, like Felix Dzerzhinsky, future head of the Cheka, Yakov Sverdlov, the prominent party organizer whom we met a while back working in the secretariat of the party, Alexandra Kollontai, one of the most prominent women in the Bolshevik party and future commissar of social welfare, Varvara Yakovleva, whom we met in Moscow during the state conference in August, Andrei Bubnov, who was the bridge between the Central and Petersburg committees, sitting on both. Moisey Uritsky, who served briefly as the head of the Petrograd Cheka. Georgi Lomov, the youngest member of the Central Committee. And finally, Grigory Sokolnikov, a Moscow Bolshevik who had traveled back to Russia with Lenin in the sealed train in April. At this meeting, everyone spoke, and the conversation was at times tense and heated, although we do not have minutes from the meeting, unfortunately, so we know what happened only from records made after the fact. Even among those who supported Lenin's call for an insurrection and agreed it was necessary, there were doubts they could actually pull it off. But Lenin was unwavering and insistent in his argumentation. And at the end of the meeting, by a vote of 10-2, the Central Committee adopted a resolution making armed insurrection the immediate strategic goal of the Bolshevik Party. The text of this resolution is very short, but I have included it as a supplemental to this episode, since it is of immense historical significance. The two votes against the resolution were cast by Zinoviev and Kamenev. Lenin was at first disappointed and a bit angry that these two old Bolsheviks, with him since the split from the Mensheviks in 1903, were now, at this crucial moment in the revolution for which they'd all been working, getting cold feet. But very quickly, his disappointment and anger turned to apoplexy and wrath when these two actively began militating against the Central Committee's decision. As word began to spread of the Central Committee's resolution on the 10th of October, there was quite the buzz in Petrograd and the party. At first, it was proposed that the Congress of Soviets of the Northern Oblast, often translated as the Northern Regional Congress, simply declare itself the new government. The Northern Regional Congress included the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, Finland, Petrograd, and other territories thereabouts. The Congress was known for being very militantly left, with a combined 75 of the 94 delegates coming from the Bolsheviks and left SRs. This Congress had convened in September, and even before the Central Committee meeting on the 10th, there was a not crazy expectation that the Congress would challenge Kerensky and his government. However, within a week after the Central Committee meeting, it was clear the Congress would not do that, for two main reasons. The first was, the Bolsheviks in this Congress doubted that the party was at all prepared to overthrow the government in the technical sense of having units ready to go and a logistical plan. And they had a point. Overthrowing an existing government, even one as weak and flailing as Kerensky's was in mid-October, requires a level of logistical planning and support akin to a military operation. It should not be something that gets thrown together at the last minute. The second reason was that, even as the struggle between the Tsikh and the Soviets for a second All-Russian Congress of Soviets was happening, the expectation was always that it was going to happen. After the Congress was confirmed, insofar as this organ was legitimate in the eyes of the workers, a regional Congress jumping the gun ahead of a national Congress on such an important issue would likely not have been received well, and possibly even rejected, which would undermine the entire seizure of power. So the Northern Regional Congress opted to defer to the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets. Meanwhile, Lenin was absolutely infuriated to find that his erstwhile comrades, Zinoviev and Kamenev, were working almost around the clock to undermine the decision taken by the Central Committee. Now, to be fair to them, they genuinely believed this uprising to be a mistake, and were doing what they thought was best. That is, they were committed Bolsheviks, not Menshevik or SR agents, and they believed the planned uprising was premature. Failure would almost guarantee the end of the revolution, and Zinoviev and Kamenev were appalled by the all-in attitude that seemed to be sweeping the party. Also, to be fair to them, they were not doing anything Lenin had not done before by appealing directly to the party rank and file to plead their case. So it is a bit hypocritical that Lenin, of all people, was mad that those who disagreed with him were writing articles and speaking at meetings and doing everything in their power to advocate for what they thought was the correct line. But on the other hand, the difference here is that, for the most part, when Lenin was engaging in direct appeals to the party rank and file, he was arguing for his position during the debate phase of the process, ahead of any decision being made by the party. This was not always the case, mind you, but it was almost always the case. And any other decision the party had taken throughout 1917, except maybe the decision to mobilize against Kornilov, paled in comparison to the implications of the decision to adopt armed insurrection against the government. Kamenev and Zinoviev were actively undermining the October 10 revolution, a resolution adopted by the leading body of the party, and which was being confirmed in other areas of the party, including the Petersburg Committee. Remember that the party operated on the principle of democratic centralism, the idea that, while debate was going on, any and everybody was free to argue for what they thought was best, but that once a decision was made, no matter what they had been arguing before, everyone was expected to support that decision. So it was one thing for Lenin to argue vociferously during the debate period. It was another thing entirely for Zinoviev and Kamenev to undermine an official decision that has been made by the leading body of the party. In fact, Kamenev and Zinoviev lobbied the Bolsheviks in the Northern Regional Congress especially hard, which had played a big role in its decision not to challenge the government. Further complicating matters for Lenin and the Central Committee was the fact that Kamenev and Zinoviev were not the only prominent voices in the party wary of affecting an armed uprising. Probably the organization most hesitant, at least initially, was the military organization. In Episode 9, Reaction and Recovery, we discussed how the Bolsheviks endured the backlash against them in the wake of the July days. At the time, I skipped over the details of the military organization for the sake of a more concise story, but now is the time to bring it up. The military organization was the branch of the Bolshevik Party that was responsible for organizing the armed forces during the revolutionary period, and it was very badly burned in the wake of the July days. If you remember, that insurrection in Petrograd had started with groups of soldiers in the capital. And so after the crisis had passed, the military organization had to answer some very awkward questions that amounted to, why did we not know this was a possibility, and how could you let this happen? After this, the military organization became rather conservative in its assessment of the mood of the armed forces, with the result that now, in October, they were very hesitant to sign off on another armed insurrection. Even with Lenin being vocal about his ardent support in a direct reversal of the July days, the military organization was very pessimistic about the preparedness of the armed forces for overthrowing the government. There was also real concern that the worker rank and file of the party would not heed the call to arms. There's a difference between demanding the transfer of power to the Soviets and hating the government, and actually taking up arms to effect this demand. The latter entails all sorts of risks, and the workers in Petrograd, while no less passionate about the desire to see Kerensky gone, were, at this moment, in mid-October, hesitating to take decisive action, in part due to concerns of reprisals from bosses and the government should the uprising fail. Faced with this battery of concerns over support from the masses, a lack of logistical and technical preparedness, and doubts being expressed within the party itself, including by two members of the Central Committee, on the 16th of October, the Central Committee again met to reassess its resolution from just 6 days prior. At this meeting, Lenin gave an impassioned and extremely persuasive defense of the Central Committee's resolution for armed insurrection. The crux of his argument was that it was not only the correct approach. He repeated over and over that power must be seized now, not in a few weeks or months, but now, as soon as possible. But also, that if the party concerned itself with the mood of the masses as the measure by which they should act, they would ultimately wind up betraying the masses. This might seem paradoxical, particularly if one is looking for a reason to accuse Lenin of being anti-democratic or power-hungry. How can you betray the masses by trying to act in accordance with their will? But what Lenin meant was, the attitudes of the masses fluctuate, sometimes very rapidly over a short period of time, and are impossible to gauge accurately. The party leadership needed to understand that the masses, by joining the party, had expressed their trust in them. That trust must not be betrayed. Basically, he reminded the Bolshevik leadership that they were the vanguard party, and as important as it was for the vanguard party of the proletariat to root itself in the proletariat, to attract the majority of workers to its side, to assemble the troops, as it were. At this moment in mid-October, the troops are assembled. They've been assembled for a minute now, pretty much since the victory over Kornilov. The inaction of the leadership is causing a lull in the mood of the masses, but this does not absolve the leadership of its duty to lead. And leading means bold action, taking calculated risks. It means recognizing when the moment has come and seizing it. After Lenin spoke, others at the meeting delivered their own reports with plenty of outlooks and perspectives that were much more pessimistic than Lenin's. Nikolai Krylenko from the military organization reminded those present that with each passing day, the soldiers were becoming less combative in their attitude toward the provisional government. Union representatives Shliapnikov and Schmidt reported that they did not think members of their unions would take to the streets if the party issued a call to arms. Zinoviev and Kamenev again expressed their doubts that an immediate uprising was a good idea or could be successful. But throughout all of this, Lenin insisted on a vote to reaffirm the 10th of October resolution. At the end of the meeting, after everyone had spoken and the rhetorical dust had settled, the vote was held. With a final count of 19-2, with 4 abstentions, the October 10 revolution was confirmed. Thus, armed insurrection against the provisional government was indeed the order of the day for the Bolshevik Party. Even after this reaffirmation, the debate within the party was not over. Kamenev and Zinoviev continued publishing articles decrying the resolution and warning of imminent failure if an insurrection was attempted, and other Bolsheviks at all levels and across the country repeated the concerns about logistics, timing, and risk. Lenin held firm in his position, all the while becoming angrier and angrier at Kamenev and Zinoviev for their actions. There was an interesting analogy begun by Kamenev and Zinoviev, but finished by Lenin, wherein the former pair insisted the Soviets must be wielded like a gun pointed at the head of the government to force concessions. That is, the party and the Soviets ought to rely on the threat of force to keep the government in check. To this, Lenin retorted that for the threat to be credible, the gun has to be loaded, and one must be willing to pull the trigger. Kerensky and the provisional government had proven time and again, over and over and over, that they would rather ignore the Soviets and even use military force, first Russian and maybe soon German, to destroy them. Indecision at this moment, a refusal to load the gun and pull the trigger, would be disastrous. This leaves us with one final piece of the puzzle to put in place. We have mentioned several times the impact of World War I on the internal politics of Russia during 1917, but we have hardly mentioned the back and forth of the war itself. To understand the final puzzle piece of the overthrow of the provisional government, we need to discuss just a bit the latest developments at the front. In August, the German fleet was able to take Riga and push the Baltic fleet all the way back into the Finnish Gulf, which put them dangerously close to Petrograd. I mentioned earlier that there is no direct evidence of the government planning to let Petrograd fall to the Germans in the hopes that the Germans could do what the Russian government could not, break the workers' movement and destroy the radical left. But there is some evidence that the government was planning on moving to Moscow, far away from both the war front and the radical masses who had been causing Kerensky nothing but trouble for months now. And Mikhail Rodzianka, remember him, the former chairman of the Fourth and Final Duma, an early key figure in the formation of the provisional government, and a right-wing politician? Well, he went around publicly declaring that Petrograd could go to hell and take its radical masses with it. Again, we can hardly blame the Bolsheviks and the workers for expecting the betrayal of the provisional government any moment now. It was, after all, the Germans, well, the Prussians, technically, who joined forces with the French government to destroy the Paris Commune. The very real military threat posed by the Germans was weighing heavily on the people of Petrograd, of all parties, class, and standing. The government, in response to this threat, began seriously preparing to transfer garrisons from the capital to the front. As a general concept, this might seem completely logical and not problematic at all. The enemy is threatening your capital, so you move troops from the capital to the front to stop them. Obvious, right? However, we are well acquainted by now with the material realities this specific proposal entailed, and what a threat this posed to the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, and the revolution as a whole. The political calculation for Kerensky was simple: transfer the troublesome Petrograd garrisons out of the capital and replace them with troops from the front who would be grateful to Kerensky for getting them out of the trenches, and hence more loyal. This would also have the added bonus of transferring away a large number of Petro-Soviet deputies. The city garrisons had been struggling side by side with the workers of Petrograd for months, and as we know, had been extremely active in the Soviet thus far. A strong bond had been forged between the workers and the soldiers in Petrograd. But by swapping out the soldiers, that bond would be broken. The new troops, unfamiliar with the people of the capital among whom they were now living, might be persuaded to do away with the Petro-Soviet altogether, or at the very least, join it and start pulling it back toward the government and away from the Bolsheviks. Troops from the front, for their part, still absolutely wanted an end to the war, but would settle at least for a transfer far away from the front and to the rear. Front troops were starting to voice some frustration with and resentment toward the troops in the rear, who had been lucky enough to find themselves in cities instead of trenches. It seemed to the front troops their brethren in the rear were loath to give up their relative comfort and did not seem at all bothered by the plight of the troops in the trenches. There had only been one thing stopping Kerensky from issuing the transfer orders. Doing so would have been a violation of the promise the provisional government had given in early March that the Petrograd garrisons, after their role in overthrowing the Tsar, were not to be transferred out of the capital. Transferring troops at any moment prior to mid-October would have been understood as a flagrantly political move, and likely would have provoked a mutiny and uprising. But now, with the threat of German troops weighing heavily on everyone's mind. Thus reasoned Kerensky. Meanwhile, the people of Petrograd, and especially the soldiers, of course understood this calculus as well. They took the rumors of the impending troop transfers as proof positive that the government was, in fact, plotting to destroy the revolution. Faced with a choice between fighting the army of another bourgeois government over imperial spoils, or joining with that army to put down a challenge from his own working and peasant classes, nobody had any illusions that Kerensky would side with the workers and peasants. In other words, everyone expected class solidarity to trump imperial antagonisms. This still left the matter of actually affecting the order without provoking a rebellion. It was, in fact, such a foregone conclusion that the garrison would disobey the order that the mere rumor of such an impending order prompted the Petro-Soviet to recognize that it would have to be involved in the order in some form or fashion if there was any hope of the order being followed. While it was clear as day why Kerensky would want to transfer the garrisons out of Petrograd, for the workers and soldiers, this was quickly turning into a lose-lose situation. The threat from the German army was as real as anything. Transferring troops would be bad. Not transferring troops would also be bad if it meant the Germans would enter the city. The Petro-Soviet, with its Bolshevik majority but still sizable presence of Mensheviks and SRs, knew it had to do something. Thus, on the 9th of October, the Executive Committee of the Petro-Soviet discussed two proposals for forming a military committee to address the concerns of the garrison troops. The Menshevik SR bloc proposed instructing the troops to prepare for deployment to the front, but promising to form a special committee in the Soviet for the evaluation and coordination of defense needs in the capital. The Bolsheviks put forward a much more militant proposal, drafted by Trotsky, which demanded immediate peace with Germany as the only hope for Russia and the revolution, transfer of power to the Soviets, and, without mentioning deployment to the front, called on the Petrograd garrison troops to prepare to fight, should the need arise. The Bolshevik proposal included the formation of a revolutionary defense committee, charged with preparing the capital, the soldiers, and the workers for defending the revolution, against the Germans if they attacked Petrograd, or possibly even against the provisional government if necessary. Both proposals were debated in the executive committee, with the Menshevik SR proposal being approved. This was somewhat surprising, considering the Bolsheviks had the majority. Apparently, there were some Bolsheviks who were, even at this point, not quite ready to make such a provocative move against the government. But later that evening, at a plenary meeting of the Petro-Soviet, the Bolshevik proposal won the day with an overwhelming majority of the workers' and soldiers' deputies in the Soviet. And so it was on the evening of the 9th of October, a full 24 hours before the start of the Bolshevik Central Committee meeting at which Lenin's resolution of armed insurrection was adopted for the party, that the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet was formed. It must be pointed out that, at least initially, the MRC, as I will abbreviate it, was not created for the express goal of overthrowing the government. After its formation was approved by the Soviet, further debates landed on the role of the MRC as strictly defensive, an understanding which included preventing the transfer of the city garrison troops to the front, but it was not a committee from which to launch an attack on the provisional government. At least, not yet. It is also important to understand that the MRC was not a Bolshevik party organ. It was an organ of the Petro-Soviet. While the Bolsheviks were the majority in the Petro-Soviet and came to hold three of the five leadership roles on the MRC, the other two were held by left SRs. And there were, at first, conflicting opinions and ideas about how the MRC should function and what its role ultimately should be. Lenin was one of the first to understand that the MRC could, in fact, serve as a way for the Petro-Soviet, not the Bolshevik Party, but the Petro-Soviet as a whole, to organize and coordinate the masses of Petrograd, the workers, soldiers, and sailors alike, into an offensive against the government. In fact, we now have all the components in place for the final push against Kerensky by the Soviets. Lenin is back in Petrograd. The Bolshevik Party has practically declared war on the provisional government. We have the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets coming up on the 25th of October. The Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petro-Soviet has been formed and tasked with the need to protect the revolution. And we have the, at this point, completely tone-deaf provisional government blundering forward with plans to transfer the Petrograd garrisons to the front, or at least as far from the capital as they can get, prompting the Petro-Soviet and the Bolsheviks to prepare to resist. Lenin, ever the masterful dialectical analyst, has determined that the material conditions are right for a killing stroke against the bourgeoisie. But the blow must be delivered as quickly as possible. Even as the party has adopted the resolution for armed insurrection and affirmed it, and started taking serious steps towards carrying it out, the expectation among most of the other Bolshevik leaders is that it will still take a few weeks to move everything in position. But Lenin, as of about the 18th or so, when the Congress is rescheduled to the 25th, begins pushing, demanding that the overthrow occur before the Congress opens, so within days, not weeks. There are two main reasons for Lenin coming to this conclusion. The first is that he wanted to present the Congress with a fait accompli, the established fact that the provisional government is no more. He knew that putting the matter up to a vote in the Congress or the Soviets would only lead to endless debates, and perhaps a collapse of popular support for the Soviets and the Bolsheviks if the SRs and Mensheviks were given the opportunity to sway the masses and denounce the Bolsheviks as criminals or bandits or what have you, for even contemplating overthrowing the government. A debate in the Congress or the Soviets would only ensure that nothing would be done, and that the unity of the masses would be undermined, thereby destroying any chance the masses have, right now, of sweeping away the government they so despised, and which was so utterly failing to resolve the issues facing them. 1917 had been, in a word, messy. We've been in the whirlwind of the revolution for months. The debates within the Bolshevik Party itself, the Russian masses being pulled in multiple directions at once, the Soviets going from inspirational revolutionary bodies to bastions of opportunism and collaboration, back to radical organs of mass politics, and the Mensheviks and SRs proving time and again that they stand with the bourgeoisie instead of the people. Given all of this, I think it is impossible to argue that Lenin was wrong, that what was needed at this moment was action, not more debate, more deliberation, more words. The second reason Lenin was adamant about overthrowing the government as soon as possible was, as we have seen, time was not on the side of the Soviets or the Bolsheviks. The Germans were encroaching nearer and nearer to the capital. Kerensky was likely going to move the capital to Moscow at the first opportunity. Petrograd troops being transferred to the front would be disastrous. And any delay risked the mood of the masses falling below the threshold of taking action. With the authority of the government evaporating before their very eyes, a power vacuum was being created. And if the Bolsheviks, with their ranks swollen by the enormous influx of workers, soldiers, sailors, and peasants over the preceding weeks, did not step in to fill it, either someone else would, or the entire system would collapse in on itself. Peace with Germany was now the only way to prevent the Germans from destroying the revolution. Lenin knew that every day that passed where the provisional government was not overthrown was a day lost. The moment to strike was now. The people were united in the Bolshevik Party. Lenin's theory of the vanguard party was bearing fruit. If the leadership let the moment pass, it would not matter if the German army or the provisional government came after them. The masses would abandon the party as quickly as they had joined it. Failure to act now constituted a betrayal of the working class, its movement, and the revolution. The week before the overthrow of the provisional government on the 25th, Lenin was a whirlwind of frenetic energy, meeting with representatives from the military organization, talking to the various committees and comrades, demanding action, and insisting that delay, by one more day, by one more hour, could cost the working class everything they had struggled to build over the last 8 months. Historically, traditionally, the 25th of October is the date we circle on the calendar, in red, of course, as the Great October Revolution. Much like with the February Revolution, however, wherein the final act, the abdication of the Tsar on the 1st of March, was actually the culmination of what had been going on for days prior, the events directly leading to the cumulative act of the overthrow of the provisional government unfolded over a couple of days. So we will leave things here for now, with all the pieces finally in place. And next time, we will go through the final days of the provisional government, the actual overthrow of said government, and the fallout at the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets when the Bolsheviks announced to the deputies of the Congress and the world what they had done. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars, Kat Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathini, Jack, Josue Ponce, Long Luke, and Ryan Fowler. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания!